on the bottom. At the foot of Mommy's bed, her suitcase lay open. Because she had no dresser, she lived from her bag, the one I'd hurriedly packed for her. She reached down, pulled out a coat from her luggage, and chuckled. "So why'd you put this in here?" she smirked. "In this climate, I certainly didn't need a coat." I rolled my eyes. She went on to mention that I'd accidentally given her mismatched shoes. I knew my mother was half-joking, but her complaining annoyed me. How the heck was I supposed to know what to pack? Didn't she understand the stress I'd been under just trying to keep neighbors from looting? "I did my best," I muttered. "At least you got a bag." That exchange set the tone for our visit. Day after day, Mommy talked constantly about how sad she was, how excruciating her split from my father had been. Through the eyes of adulthood, I now understand my mother was still reeling from all she had been through. And if I found her new lifestyle difficult to accept, she must have found it incomprehensible. She was also recovering from the heartache of separation, because make no mistake, she was going through one. She and Papi hadn't married, but their breakup was as devastating as any legal separation. At the airport and party, the two had been cordial for my sake, but all they wanted was to steer clear of each other. I felt sorry for my mother, yet at the same time, I blamed her for our predicament. By reopening the case in New Jersey, she made herself susceptible to deportation. On the one hand, I didn't fault her for trying to shake things up. She was desperate to move forward in her life, to finally call this country her legal home. Even still, I blamed her for the haphazard way in which she handled the situation. She never tried to get confirmation about whether her application had indeed been handed over to the feds. Instead, she got scared and let everything fall apart. And because she didn't resolve it, because she didn't see the process through to the end, she'd left our future up to chance. She'd also left us susceptible to people who wanted to do us harm. I dealt with my resentment by leaving the house. I went out a lot, mostly with my other family. I clicked with three of my cousins, Raul, Fernando, and Liz. All were within a couple years of my age. "Want to go out tonight?" Fernando would swing by and ask. "Sure," I'd say, glancing at Mommy's face to measure her degree of disappointment. To her credit, she didn't hold me back. Even before she left Boston, I'd started spending more time with my friends and less with her and Papi, so this wasn't new. The difference was that, rather than hanging out with my friends in the neighborhood, I was stepping out into the unknown. With my cousins as my tour guides, I experienced a side of Colombia I absolutely loved. There, teens generally have a lot more freedom than they do in America, so we'd be out for hours at a time. We sampled all kinds of foods. We hit the movies, the park, the mall. We danced all night at salsa clubs. It was a way to escape my reality. You name it, we did it. And I enjoyed all of it. Even with its many societal challenges, the country has this amazing energy and irresistible vibrancy, this fervor that draws you in. When I was out with my favorite trio, I was shuttling between relatives' homes. From day one, people were all over me. I felt like a celebrity. "Can Diane come over for lunch today?" one of Mommy's brothers would call and ask. An hour later, the phone would ring with an additional invitation. Everywhere I went, people wanted to feed me, talk to me, hug me, dance with me, or introduce me to their friends and family. I think I got all this attention because others saw me as unique. I was this young American girl who was still totally down with my Colombian roots. I was connected to the culture. I appreciated all the fuss, but it was easy to OD on it. My last 2 weeks were spent with Papi. His surroundings were as modest as Mommy's, but he was chill about it. If his new lot in life was bothering him, he didn't mention it. In fact, he was quiet overall and maybe a little down. At dusk, When the humidity had dropped, he'd often take me out biking. One evening, as we returned, I struck up a conversation. "Papi?" I asked. "Yes, Diane," he said. "What is it?" "Do you think someone turned you and Mommy in?" He paused. "What do you mean?" he asked. "One of the guards at the detention told Mommy that someone probably snitched on you guys." "I don't know, Diane," he said. He looked away from me. And at this point, he went on, "I guess it doesn't matter. We're here now. There's not much I can do about it." I shrugged, wheeled my bike into the garage, and left the mystery at that. On the Sunday of my last week, Papi surprised me. "I want to take you someplace special for your birthday," he said, "just the two of us." In Latin cultures, turning 15 is a big deal for a girl. It marks the beginning of womanhood. Years before, I told my parents I had no desire for a quinceañera, the traditional ceremony complete with white gloves and ball gowns. Not my thing. But I did want some kind of party, and in fact, I'd already had three. One thrown by my mother, a second by my father's sister, and a third courtesy of my cousins. So when Papi told me he'd top all of that off with a vacay, I was thrilled. "Where are we going?" I asked. "I'm taking you to Cartagena," he told me. I raised my eyebrows. "Really, Papi?" I squealed. I'd heard that the historic city on the Caribbean coast was one of Colombia's most gorgeous. "Yes, really," he said, laughing. "I used some of my savings to buy us our tickets. We'll go this week." I wasn't just excited. Given the scarcity of cash, I was also grateful. Papi's generosity made the journey so sweet as we strolled down the streets of Old Town, savored ceviche at a quaint restaurant, and watched the red golden sunset over the silver waters. The getaway was perfect. The magic ended as soon as I returned to Palmira. When I mentioned the trip to Mommy, she teared up. "Wow," she said. "It would have been nice to be there with you." Hearing that we'd gone away without her brought up all the pain of her split from Papi. The sadness in Mommy's eyes reminded me of how wacky our lives had been. Both of my parents went to the airport to see me off. "Why don't you come live here?" Mommy said. I didn't respond. As much as I relished certain things about the trip, I knew there was no life for me there. Mommy knew it too. Papi stood quiet. In fact, he'd never said one way or the other whether he wanted me to move there. He probably knew it was pointless to give his opinion because I'd clearly made up my mind. I heard my call to board. I kissed each of them goodbye and set off for the one homeland I'd ever truly known. More change awaited me in Boston. That July, Amelia had relocated from Rosendale to a two-bedroom in Roxbury. Gabby's brother had moved out, so although the new house was smaller, there was one less person sharing the space. Gabby and I shared one room. Amelia and her oldest daughter were in the other. I began my sophomore year, no longer a newbie. I was still finding my way in the music department, and I loved it. I was into my classes, and I was excited about developing as a student and an artist. That fall semester also came with a bonus. Gabby became my classmate. "You'd like it here," I'd repeatedly told her the year before. "You should audition." She did, and a few weeks later, she received the same letter that once gave me a reason to keep going. The only thing better than being at Boston Arts was having a close friend there. After eighth grade, Dana had moved to Florida with her family, and Sabrina went to a different high school. Still my homies, though, don't get it twisted. It was great to have a familiar friend in high school, and even better to know that my other girls would be friends forever. Following that huge taste of freedom in Palmira, I returned ready to spread my social wings. At a movie theater near campus, a bunch of my friends and I would hang out after school. We'd play around, snap photos of each other, but the old school kind that you have to get developed at Walgreens, LOL, and just be ridiculous. That year, we were obsessed with John Leguizamo, the Colombian-American comedian. He released his HBO special, Sexaholics, and we memorized all of it. We were really annoying after a while, but we were excited to see a Latino on TV. He was speaking our language, bringing up issues we cared about. Finally, someone we could relate to. We entertained ourselves by reciting every joke the guy had told. It was the best time. And then 9/11 hit. Along with the rest of the nation, I watched in horror as the hijacked planes hit the Twin Towers. American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175 had originated in our backyard at Logan. Both planes were filled with Bostonians, adding to the death toll of those lost in New York and Pennsylvania. The day was terrifying. We all held our breath, uncertain whether more attacks were coming. Amelia rushed home early from work to pick up Gabby and me. The next 2 days, we stayed home. Even once we returned to school, a funk lingered in the air. What was true in my own life became true for our nation. You can quickly get back on your feet right after a disaster, but real healing takes longer. The year progressed, and as it did, I became super focused on my studies. For the first time, I fully understood why my parents had put so much on the line to come to the States, and I intended to make good on that opportunity. Not only did I buckle down in school, I became even more conscientious around Amelia's house. I was determined to keep my spot, my chance. One evening that December, I called Amelia on her cell. She and Gabby had gone out to run some errands. I was studying. "May I please walk to the store down the street?" I asked her. "Why don't you wait till later?" she said. "We'll be there shortly. Gabby can go with you." But I persisted. I wanted to buy some colored pencils for an art project. She gave in. "Okay, but don't be gone for long." I knew the route well. Gabby and I passed the store every day on our way to the T. I pressed the crosswalk button. The go signal appeared. So I looked both ways and began strolling across the street. When I was about halfway to the other side, a green Mazda swerved out in front of me and boom! Crashed into the right side of my body. The driver, a young white woman, hurried from the driver's side and over to me. I laid sprawled out on the pavement, moaning. "Miss, miss," the lady screamed. "What the hell were you doing crossing the street like that?" She reached down and took my hand. With her help, I slowly stood. I looked down and noticed that my knees were bloody. My right arm throbbed as if it was about to fall off. "Let me call 911, she said, searching her pocket for her phone. I grabbed her arm. "Please don't," I screamed. "I'm fine." "But miss," she said, "you're hurt." "Go, go, 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 go," I begged, tears flooding my face. "I'm okay, I'm okay." I'd just gotten the crap knocked out of me, and yet one thought reeled through my head. Do not cause any trouble. If the police showed up, they might realize my parents had been deported and throw me in foster care. Aside from that, I refused to hassle Amelia. In fact, I didn't want anyone to know I'd been hit. I planned to stay as far under the radar as my family had always been. Rather than calling for help, I hobbled to the house, cleaned myself up, and came up with a story about how I hurt myself. "Oh my God, what happened?" Amelia said the second she opened the door and saw me limping. She put her groceries on the counter and rushed to my side of the sofa. "Oh, it's nothing," I lied. I fell on the street. "You did?" she said. "Why didn't you tell me? Are you okay?" "I'm fine," I assured her. It's not a big deal." But, of course, Amelia insisted on taking me to the ER to be checked. Once there, doctors discovered that I had cracked my wrist. Hours later and a few weeks before Christmas, I left the hospital in a cast I'd had to wear for 6 weeks. I spent the final days of 2001 recovering from a broken arm, regretting the deep fracture in my family, and hoping I'd wake up to discover that the last 4 months had only been a bad dream. Chapter 10. Butterfly. Artists are the emotional historians of the world. Richard Blanco, first immigrant and Latino to be a U.S. inaugural poet. "Hello? Diane?" "Hi, puppy," I said. I'd been chilling on the sofa listening to India Ri's song, ready for love when my dad's name popped up on the caller ID. He usually rang on the weekends. This was a weekday. "What is it?" I asked. He paused. "I got a call from Amelia today," he said.
"You did?"
I asked. My pulse quickened.
"Everything okay?"
He stopped. "She cannot have you there any longer." I got up from the couch and walked out toward the balcony to get some privacy.
"But, I mean, why?"
I stammered.
"Because her oldest daughter just found out she's pregnant," he told me.
"She is?" I said. I'd seen Gabby's sister every day that week and I hadn't noticed a change in her mood or demeanor.
"Yes," he told me.
"And with the baby coming, there's not enough room for you." My mind scrambled to process what he'd told me. Did I cause this? What did I do? What makes them want to get rid of me all of a sudden? Things seemed pretty perfect between Gabby and me, but earlier that week we had argued. Nothing major, just a tiff between friends. But upon learning this news from Papi, I concluded that our disagreement must have prompted Amelia's decision. I pressed my father for more information.
"So did I do something wrong?"
I asked. My voice shook.
"Are they upset with me about something?"
"No, mija," he told me. It's not about anything you did, not at all. It's only because the house is too small." I wasn't convinced that was true. I made it all the way to the end of my sophomore year with no big dust-up. There had to be something that brought this on now. I must have recently slacked on my chores without realizing. By my silence, Papi could tell I wasn't buying his explanation. My eyes welled up with tears. Amelia and Gabby had become like family to me, and I didn't want to feel lost again.
"Look," he went on, "Amelia was only supposed to have you there a few months."
A few months? Until my father said that, I hadn't known he and Amelia had ever agreed on a timeline. "You've now been with her over a year."
"So what am I gonna do?" I asked.
"Well," he said, "I've spoken to Sabrina's parents." Upon the mention of my pal's name, a weight lifted from my shoulders. Huge exhale. "They said that they'll take you in," he assured me. He then spent 10 minutes promising me that all would be okay. I didn't want to move again. I'd gotten close to the family and didn't want to let them go. Despite Papi's reassurances, I felt lost. At a moment's notice, I could be asked to leave. That's the reality when your own family, your tribe, isn't there to keep you grounded. I was grateful that Papi had lined up my next move, and what better move than with my homie Sabrina and her parents, Eva and Don Federico. They'd come from Colombia years earlier, been granted citizenship, and owned their own home. They lived upstairs. Sabrina's aunt and elderly grandmother lived downstairs in the other part of the two family. Because we'd been friends for so long, I'd practically grown up there, like I had Amelia's. All good. Even still, this is the truth. I was sick of all the changes. I wanted one thing in my life to be steady for longer than 5 minutes. I craved stability. Amelia heard me sniffling and knew why. Papi had told her he'd talk to me that evening. She wandered onto the balcony, sidled up beside me, and placed her hand on my shoulder. "I just want you to know something, Diane," she said softly. "You didn't do anything wrong." She must have read my mind. "My daughter is having a baby," she went on. "That's it. That's the only reason." From the compassion in her eyes, I knew she was sincere. That eased the sting a bit. Once Amelia left the balcony, I wiped my tears from my face, pulled my act together, and dialed Sabrina.
"Hey, guess what?"
I said, trying to seem upbeat, although my heart was in my stomach.
"What?" she said. "I'm coming to your place," I told her.
She giggled.
"I know," she exclaimed. "My mother told me, but I couldn't say anything to you about it yet."
A week later, I packed up. Gabby helped me gather my things and saw me off.
"Sorry, dude," she told me. "I hate to see you go."
Amelia placed my bag into her trunk and drove me to Sabrina's home, which was in my old stomping grounds, Rosendale. Sabrina and her parents welcomed me warmly.
"Come on in," said Eva.
"You'll be in Sabrina's room."
And that's how the summer before my junior year began. Another house, a whole new family, and a new reason to lament that my parents had been forced out of the country. Sigh. Here we go. I got a job. Sabrina had been working at iParty, this party supply store in West Roxbury. They sold everything from streamers, balloons, and Halloween costumes to paper plates and cups. "Can you get me in?" I asked her that August. "I'll try," she said. A few weeks later, as the fall semester got underway, I was hired as a cashier at $5.15 an hour, minimum wage then. I put in 20 hours a week, mainly on weekends and a couple of days after school. "Can I catch a ride with you?" I'd ask Sabrina if our shifts overlapped. "Yep," she'd say. She had this little green Jetta. Man, she drove that thing into the ground. When Sabrina couldn't take me to iParty, I relied on the bus for the hike across town. The new responsibility was a lot to juggle with my studies, but it was worth it to me. Papi continued to send money, but his resources were dwindling. That Powerball money was a long gone. If I requested cash for, say, school supplies, he'd scrape it together. But I then later discovered he was running short on grocery money. So I stopped asking. Landing the gig meant I didn't have to depend on him or anyone. And bonus, if I wanted a cute shirt from H&M or a tube of MAC lip gloss, boom, I could purchase it for myself. It's tough to imagine that my time at Boston Arts could have gotten any better, but during my junior year, it did. That fall, Miss Jackson became the head of the vocal department. Her specialty was jazz. She encouraged us to study the greats, and she underscored the importance of good musicianship. I'd been bitten by the blues bug all those years earlier in elementary school, so I knew this was going to work out great. I immersed myself in all things jazz. I listened to Miles Davis, Roy Haynes, and Nina Simone. In the middle of the semester, Miss Jackson even gave me one of the best gifts I'd ever received, a Sarah Vaughan album. From the first note, my life was forever changed. There's something in Miss Vaughan's voice that just takes me away. I could listen to her for hours. I admired her power, her vocals, her elegance, and her ability to make me recognize both pain and our capacity for love. I studied the history, the evolution of the genre, the lyrics. Healing power lived in that music. With each note I memorized, I felt less alone. Others had been through far more than I had, and they've channeled their pain into their art. From that devastation, they created something beautiful. I wanted to, one day, do the same. Then again, I had my doubts, my insecurities, my secret fears that I'd never make it as a professional artist. Aside from that appearance at Springfest, I rarely sung duets, much less solos. I didn't want to be too showy. Staying in the background as a member of the chorus was safe. When I did step up, I thought I had to sing like someone else in order to be good. Some of the other kids at BAA were very talented. I'm talking Whitney pipes. Instead of appreciating my unique sound, I questioned my own talent because I didn't sound like them. I didn't yet have the confidence to be myself. Another concern also nagged me. If I pursued a career in the arts, how the hell would I pay my bills? Could I fully support myself after I left Eva's, once I was 18 and on my own? At the time, that survival instinct was strong, so strong, in fact, that it made me second-guess my dreams. Let's not get it twisted. Those dreams were alive and well inside me. I was that same girl who laid atop my twin mattress and fantasized about taking on Broadway. Yet, as graduation inched closer, I got more convinced that I didn't quite have the chops to earn a living as a performer. And then there was the turmoil in my family. Between school and work, I kept myself insanely busy so I wouldn't have to think about all that had happened. Buried beneath all my activity was a broken heart. I became a classic avoider, talking to my mother and father only if there was no way out of it. Whenever Eva wrapped up a chat with my mother, she'd hand me her phone and say, "Your mom wants to speak to you." I'd take the phone and think, "Here we go again." Mommy's life was one never-ending telenovela. complete with full-length episodes of drama, hardship, and agony. During our calls, she'd recount all her difficulties and even those of our relatives. By then, she'd moved into another family member's house and had her own bedroom. So that was an improvement. Yet for the most part, her calls were filled with doom and gloom. This aunt or uncle had lost a job, someone had been mugged on the way to the grocery store, and of course she'd end up sobbing over how much she wanted all of us to be together again. So did I. I just saw no point in rehashing it. "Okay, Mommy, I've gotta go," I'd say to rush her off the line. It was my 16-year-old's way of shouting, "I can't effing deal with this anymore." My poor mother. I now realize how difficult it must have been for her. But I was still 16 and cranky. Meanwhile, I'd lost touch with another family member, my niece. I seldom saw Erica. With my parents and Eric away from Boston, the drifting apart happened naturally. I did once run into her and her grandmother in the park. Erica spotted me in the crowd and yelled, "Auntie Diane! Auntie Diane!" When I turned to notice her running towards me, the whole world stopped for a moment. In the middle of the loud music, the screams, and children begging their mothers for cotton candy, I stood there dazed. She was about 7 and had gotten so much taller. It made me suddenly aware of how our lives had moved on, how quickly time was passing. "How are you, sweetie?" I said, giving her a big hug. "I miss you," she squealed. "I know," I said, still stunned. "Me too." If I was struggling at my age with my parents' deportation, it must have been crushing for her. She'd lost her father and 2 grandparents she'd lived with all before her 5th birthday. I'd at least had my parents until I was 14. Although the circumstances were out of my control, I felt like I abandoned Erica. Just thinking about that broke my heart. Following our reunion in the park, Gloria occasionally brought my niece to Sabrina's place. But between her busy schedule as a single parent and all my responsibilities, our visits petered out. By that spring, my parents had taken to leaving angry messages on my voicemail. That's how infrequently I'd reached out to them. I loved and missed them very much, as they did me, but talking to them was a reminder of everything I was desperate to forget. "Please come here, sweetie," Mommy would weep. "I need to see you." My parents persisted so much that I finally agreed. I was also well aware of the need to give Sabrina, Eva, and Don Federico a break from me, because, let's face it, after a year, even the nicest hosts want a little break. So during the summer, after my junior year, I booked a ticket for 4 weeks in Colombia. The trip was a blur. I may have gone there to spend time with my folks, but I didn't see much of them. That's because I was out chilling with my cousins, dancing at salsa clubs, and basically having a blast. It was my chance to let loose, to set aside the pressure of being a good girl, a perfect house guest. Every weekend, I hooked up with a bunch of other teens, and we went to fincas, these summer house estates where wealthy kids hang. We'd camp there all night, make fires, play in the pool, and drink. You've got to be 18 to consume liquor in Colombia, but courtesy of my older cousins, I had my first shot of aguardiente, a Colombian liquor with the name that means fire water. One shot soon became 2. Oh, and yes, let's not forget the tragic belly ring I got. They were the shit at the time, okay? So early 2000s. I thought it was cool. That is, until mine got infected and began oozing. I brought the party home with me. Senior year is when I blossomed socially. My self-doubts hadn't magically melted away, but I was becoming more sure of myself. I saved up a few $100s, which gave me a sense of power. Again, I've never had money. I threw myself into even more extracurriculars. In class and out, I was learning to express my opinions, and rather than heading straight home after work, I wanted to have a life. I started hanging out with my friends on the weekends, socializing, going to dinner, but I didn't get crazy or anything. I loved it that Eva trusted me and wanted to keep it that way. I never went buck wild or got rebellious. When my classmates who had their parents here would get into trouble for no reason, I thought it was pathetic. That probably seems judgmental, but I couldn't understand it. They had so many great things going for them, and yet they were willing to ruin it. In a way, not having Mommy and Papi close led me to give myself rules. Structure, boundaries. I wasn't conscious of it, but it was like I was parenting myself in their absence. I wanted to show people that even without my family here, I could remain on track. In the fall, I traded in my job for another near campus. My friend Sophia, a theater major and incredibly talented poet, got me in at the Barnes & Noble Cafe in the Prudential Center. She and my girl Sasha were always talking about how much they loved it there. Once I got hired, the three of us became our own little club. We called each other Habibi, an Arabic word that means my darling, because we'd heard it in Bend It Like Beckham, which we'd seen like a million times. We usually worked from 5 p.m. to close, or at the ass crack of dawn on weekends. It was fun, and I was growing up. When I wasn't whipping up cappuccinos or sneaking broken cookies into my mouth, I was hitting the books hard and prepping for the SATs. With only months left until graduation, it was time for me to figure out my path. I really wanted to do work that made some kind of a difference. Media was one idea I had. On campus, I was part of a literary and visual arts magazine called Slate Blue. Gabby, several other students, and I would gather our classmates' short stories, art, and poetry and choose the best to include in an annual collection. As part of our participation in the group, we took field trip to the offices of the Improper Bostonian, a glossy lifestyle publication. The editors there taught us the ins and outs of the magazine. While there, I daydreamed about how cool it would be to appear on the magazine's cover. But the trip did spark a thought. Maybe I could be a television news anchor. A job that would bring together my love for performing and my desire to make a contribution. A teacher had once told me I had to be very knowledgeable about politics and current events in order to be a good reporter, and that made a lot of sense. So I began exploring the possibility of studying political science and communication. To be honest, I had no friggin' clue what I'd do, but I did know I'd apply to college. The staff at BAA had ingrained that in me from the get-go. My spring semester, I was heavily committed to the dopest ensemble in school, Rhythm and Voice. The whole semester was all about preparing for my senior recital, the final evaluation. We got to choose our own songs. I picked Funny Honey from Chicago and a French classical piece. I also chose Poor Wandering One from Pirates of Penzance. And of course, there was my personal favorite, Sarah Vaughan's rendition of Poor Butterfly. Two afternoons a week, a voice coach came in to work with us one-on-one. I spent literally hours rehearsing, often even in my head while brewing coffee at Barnes. I intended to be ready. In March, many of my classmates began receiving acceptance letters from universities all over the country. I hadn't yet applied. Why? Because I was terrified that I wouldn't get in. It's not too late, Diane, my guidance counselor, Mr. McGillen, told me. I can help you with the paperwork. In response to his nudge, I made a list of women's colleges. I had this notion that in an all-female environment, I'd be able to focus. No boys to distract me. Up to then, I had had a serious boyfriend. He was a boy whose name I will not mention. He broke my heart into a million tiny pieces. You know who you are! I thought I loved you and you love me! Insert the ugliest cry face you'll ever see in your life. I'm sure every girl has come across a fuckboy or two in high school and beyond. It hurts. Anyway, I digress. I'd experienced enough to realize that even puppy love can pull your attention away from your studies. I didn't want even the possibility of nonsense. Also, I'd been reading a lot that year about Simone de Beauvoir and many other incredible feminists. Who knows why I connected my interest in feminism with going to a woman's college, but I did. I applied to 5 programs in New England, and only the 5 I thought I had a shot at. Some of my friends were aiming for Tufts and Northeastern. Not me. As hard as I'd pushed to overcome my learning disabilities and get good grades, my GPA was average, not stellar. I knew I had to be realistic. I didn't have the guts, the money, or the test scores to aim for prestigious schools. I was also fearful of leaving Boston, the only city I'd known. Even if once in college I wouldn't see as much of Eva or Amelia as I did during all of high school, I still wanted them nearby as my security blankets. That April, I got called in for a few interviews, and one of them was at the school near the top of my list, Regis College, a private Roman Catholic university a few miles outside of downtown Boston. Eva drove me to the small campus. It was gorgeous. Lush green lawns that were flawlessly maintained. Massive trees, historic brick buildings. Just being on campus felt like I was finally realizing my fantasy of living in a white suburban town. I sat in on a few classes and the vibe was wonderful. It seemed like I could really make a path for myself there, grow as a student and make lifelong friends. Everyone was so chill. And the teachers, some of whom were nuns, seemed to care about the students. Things were looking up. I knew what I'd come there to do, sell myself. Much of what I've gotten in life has had nothing to do with what's on paper, believe me. Put me in a room and I can talk myself into or out of anything. It's called the gift of gab. I went wearing a cute dress and my strand of fake pearls. I made my case to the admissions team as strongly as I could. I would be a great addition to your school, I told them passionately. I was probably the worst choice, but I wasn't about to tell them that. If you give me this opportunity, I continued, I will do everything possible to excel. A month later, boom shakalaka, I was accepted. What did they get themselves into? Whatever. I was going to college, bitches! I got into one other school, but I settled on Regis right away. It didn't hurt that they offered me a financial aid package that covered the majority of my first year costs. I did have a moment of panic, however, when I realized I still had to take out some loans. Who could sign for me? No one. And I thought it was too much to ask of Eva and Amelia. So I blundered my own way through the forms and somehow got funded. I didn't understand a lot of what I signed up for. And years later, I'd pay dearly for some of my choices. Let's just say Sally Mae and I have had words over the years. Okay, fine. We basically stopped talking after she accused me of being a thieving bitch, and I accused her of being a money-grubbing whore. Oh, but don't worry, Sally, okay? You'll get your money. A couple of weeks before the end of the term, my senior recital came around. I arose early that morning, and while showering, I warmed up my voice with some scales. I wore a beautiful pink strapless dress, one I'd picked out at Charlotte Russe, and pink flowers in my hair from my other favorite designer, H&M. I wore my mother's shawl as a good luck charm. I could still smell her perfume on it. When I arrived in the music room, which was called the Boston Conservatory, Miss Jackson, my voice coach, and a few other teachers were waiting. You ready? Asked Miss Jackson with a smile that told me she knew I was. Yes, I said with assurance, I am. The next hour was one of the most special of my life. This was my night. It was my time to shine. As I sang the pieces I'd worked so hard to polish, the music transported me somewhere else, a place where sorrow and heartache and misery do not exist. I didn't try to pull myself back into the present. Rather, I gave into the feeling, allowing it to carry me off. I ended with Poor Butterfly. It was about a Japanese girl enchanted by an American man who never returns to be with her. John Raymond Hubble wrote the song about the main character in Puccini's Madame Butterfly. I'd chosen it because it struck a powerful chord in me. The abandonment. The hoping and waiting and yearning for something that doesn't happen. I'd been so moved the first time I heard Sarah Vaughan perform it. Now it was my turn. At the end of my concert, the room went wild. Miss Jackson and the other teachers all stood and clapped, a long round of applause that meant more to me than any I've received since. Sabrina, Eva, Gabriela, and Amelia all sat beaming and clapping in the front row. I was so appreciative of their support, even though I missed my parents. I had done it, and it was a feeling better than any I'd experienced. It took so much courage for me to put my voice on display, to let myself be seen and heard as I am. And for once, I was not afraid. Someone wise once said, "There are really only two emotions, fear and love, and it's impossible to feel them at the same time." On that morning, in that room, I was surrounded by an overwhelming spirit of love alone. The recital went so well that I began to regret not applying to a conservatory. But I'd placed a foot on the path toward Regis in the fall of 2004. So in my mind, that meant it was too late. Someone should have talked me out of that. The entire school year and all the way up through vacation, my mommy and papi called. And called. And called. It was as if they could sense I was drifting further and further away from them, and they were grasping to hold on to something, anything, that would keep our relationship intact. They'd missed a lot. Proms, recitals, birthdays. Think about all the things that happened between ages 14 and 18. All the markers we hit. How we change and develop and step into our personalities. At the end of my years at Boston Arts, I was already a little adult. I'd grown up from that girl once frightened and shivering under a bed into a poised young woman. A butterfly. Ready to spread my wings and navigate my life. And my parents, as deeply as they wished otherwise, hadn't been there to witness any of the transformation. Chapter 11. New World. Life begins at the end of your comfort zone. Neil Donald Walsh, author. The day I set foot on campus, I knew I made a mistake. A big one. It's not that Regis seemed any less ideal than it had during my visit. It was more stunning in fall than it had been in spring, and it was buzzing with the students' energies of a fresh start. But after that memorable recital, my doubts about my direction had grown louder. Why didn't I try for a conservatory, I kept thinking. And why am I not in New York? I'd rushed to do the whole university thing because it was the next logical step. I now realize I could have taken a year off to get clear about what I wanted. Oh well. Right away, I had to make a huge adjustment to how, shall I put this? Le white girls. I'd befriended sprinkles of Caucasians who'd been at Boston Arts, most of them the Jamaica Plain clog-wearing crunchy granola types. But the girls at Regis were different, and those variations extended beyond race. There were the hoity-toity suburban girls, super nerds and super religious girls, girls who didn't get into Wellesley, oh, and lesbians. Lots and lots of lesbians. Within a week of being there, I had my first lesbian experience. Phew! Now that I got that over with, what's next? There were also quite a number of black and brown girls, but not nearly as many as I was used to. And I didn't find much of an artsy crowd, other than the emo goths in the theater department. No more music and no more fantasy. I was stuck. I missed my crew. Gabby had enrolled at Pine Manor College in the greater Boston area. Sabrina was in the city too, attending beauty school to become a hairdresser. Sophia, my Barnes bud, had gone off to Hofstra University in New York. Sabrina, Gabby, and their moms all dropped me off in my dorm room a week ahead of the fall semester.
"You always have a spot in our house," Eva assured me as we hugged goodbye.
"You can visit any time." And I did sleep over on some weekends and holidays. But you know how it goes. After you move away, you don't often keep in touch, even when your loved ones are nearby. That's especially true once you get caught up in your new life. And soon enough, I did. I immediately clicked with my roommate, Adrienne, this gorgeous girl with auburn hair and green eyes. She'd been raised in a progressive community in the Berkshires. When she pulled out a Les Mis poster and hung it over her bed, I knew she was my kind of roomie. Artsy, earthy, cool. A good fit with my artsy, cool, undecided. As the year got underway, I did make more friends in class and in other school activities and functions around campus. I connected with a group of pals, including Paula, a Puerto Rican Republican in love with George Bush, Gemma, who was from Maine, super fun and incredibly diligent and organized, Jenny, who was mild-mannered and studying to be a nurse, and Sarah, who was then exploring the goth alternative lifestyle. Especially during that first year at Regis, race was on my mind a lot because the topic was part of my curriculum. I'd chosen poli-sci and communications as a major. With my eye on a media career, I was hungry to educate myself, to learn about all the various philosophies. I read voraciously. Plato's The Republic, Niccolo Machiavelli's The Prince, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Of the Social Contract. I'd get so attached to whatever I was reading that I'd switch my view. After some Henry David Thoreau, I'd be like, revolution is the only way to achieve justice! Then, following a little Aldous Huxley, I'd start spouting off about pacifism. I wasn't simply reading, I was also carving out a belief system, an identity, a place to fit in as a Latina and a female and a millennial. Trouble is, from one course to the next, I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be a Black Panther or a Mahatma Gandhi. Depended on my mood. Hashtag mood. I'd bug out about certain issues that plagued my mind, things like racial and societal inequality, reproductive rights, and overall injustices. If I talked in class about wealth distribution being our world's only hope and a white girl made a snarky remark, I'd snap, are you talking to me, you fascist right-wing schoolgirl, you? You know nothing! Much of my anger was misplaced. I was furious that I'd lost my mother and father. Furious that those around me were from communities where my reality wasn't part of the conversation. Furious that others paid little attention to the existence of undocumented workers. My family's struggle to remain in America had defined my childhood. Yet immigration wasn't on their radars. They had absolutely no idea what I'd been through. That was by design. I shared a lot with my friends, but I initially avoided that kryptonite of conversations, my parents' whereabouts. Are you going home to see your folks? A friend would ask. Oh no, I'd tell her. They relocated overseas a few years ago. While that was technically true, I'm sure she thought my parents were in the French Alps or Tahiti, not living hand to mouth in the third world. If she and others pressed the point, I quickly changed the subject because I was ashamed. Aside from that, I didn't want to be seen as a victim. I'd done my share of sulking. I was ready to turn the page on the poor Diane story. For most of my friends, summer break was summer break. That time when they traded in their studies for, say, a Tuscany vacation? For me, however, the off-season was a reason to panic. I was worried about where I'd go and how I'd earn money. After freshman year, I headed to Eva's place, but that got old really fast. Not only was I nervous about wearing out my welcome, I also wanted to show that I could at last be independent. Who wants to be a permanent charity case? I didn't. But since neither of my parents nor I had the cash to fly me to Colombia, I had to figure out something. So at the end of my freshman year, I became an orientation leader, a job that included giving tours to prospective students and, bingo, staying in the dorms for free during June, July, and August. Second summer down, two to go. Holidays were tricky as well. While others were preparing to deck the halls, I was stressing about whether my loans would cover the spring term. I want you to come here in December, Mommy told me. I haven't spent Christmas with you in 4 years. In the winter of 2005, her plea got through to me and I arranged a trip. I didn't have the money for the airfare, so God bless Gabby's sister who put the $800 ticket on her credit card. I'll pay you back, I promised, which, by the way, I did. When all you've got is your reputation, you learn to be impeccable with your word. I'm anal about promptly repaying my friends, as well as returning in pristine condition any items I've borrowed. Christmas in Colombia was amazing. I'd heard about people going from house to house, singing and reciting verses during La Novena, exactly as we'd done in Boston, only multiplied by 20. The stories didn't come close to the experience itself. There were parties all over the place, homes lit with hundreds of twinkling lights, parks and plazas aglow with nativity displays, children playing in the streets. Those who had jobs set them aside for the month. Music and fireworks filled the air. Over the years, one of my aunts had often sent me tapes of pretty Christmas carols. Some were those we sing here, such as Silent Night and The Little Drummer Boy. Others were traditional choruses like Vamos, 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 pastorcito, and Los Pastores de Belén. The sounds, the sights, the taste of buñuelos and mazamorra, Colombian pastries and corn-like pudding. It all brought the season to life and created this enormous national fiesta. Mommy and I exchanged gifts. I'd brought her the usual items on the list: eyeliner, lotion, perfume, makeup. Early that Christmas morning, before I'd gotten out of bed, she came into my room and handed me a package. My eyes lit up. "Open it," she said. I removed the tape from the layers of pink tissue paper inside. I found a stack of 7 underwear, one in every color of the rainbow. "Thank you," I whispered. I was half asleep, but awake enough to reach over and embrace her. To anyone else, the present would have appeared to be a set of basic cotton undies. To me, it was a symbol of my mother's care. It took me back to those days when I was 4 and 7 and 10, and the years when Mommy had been there to give me a personal item that often only a mother would buy for her daughter. It probably sounds funny, but I still look forward to receiving panties from my mother. It was after that Christmas break that I began thinking about how I could eventually bring my parents to the States again. Could I do that? What would the barriers be? Upon completing college, would I be able to lock down a good job, save up, and hire a respectable attorney? I had none of the answers. But my time with Mommy had reminded me of how lonely I felt without her and Papi here. How much I needed them. I didn't tell either of them what I was considering. Instead, I stashed away the thought. It gave me something to look forward to anticipate, to pray about. We all need that. Dreams are what keep us alive, after all. You'd think my sweet reunion with Mommy would have prompted me to call her and Papi more regularly. It didn't. Same song, 17th verse. I would have given just about anything for them to be closer. Yet, I also needed to keep some distance between a situation I was powerless to alter myself. By this point, my parents had gotten used to me going underground. They stopped giving me shit about it. That battle was lost, and they knew it. Which might be why Mommy smartly switched her tactic from demanding to guilt-tripping. "Diane," she'd say on my voicemail that March. "I get so sad when you don't call me." A day later, I returned her call. Now, years later, I recall that particular conversation. The mother I'd known as a girl, the one who gently stroked my hair and tucked me into bed, showed up during that call. This time, Mommy didn't mention the heartache of 2001. She didn't speak of how badly she wanted to be with Papi again. She didn't linger on the daily hardships of her life in Colombia. Rather, she asked me a simple question, one I've carried with me since. "How are you, my princess, really?" She then listened. Fully listened, as I told her. I hadn't been there to see all the ways in which it was happening, but my mom was shifting. She was moving past the trauma and the outrage and the grief and settling into a quiet acceptance of things, not as she wanted them to be, but as they were. We don't do all our growing up between birth and adolescence, or even in our 20s. If we're fortunate, we never stop. My classes were kicking my butt. As hard as I was working, I was still pulling only B's and C's. That's all good, but I wanted better. I couldn't understand why better was out of my reach when I was making such an effort. It's not like I was partying or procrastinating. So I went in to talk to my counselor.
"Have you been tested for a learning disability?" he asked.
I hadn't.
Once I took the test, the results came in. We discovered those two culprits I'd been dealing with since elementary school, ADD and dyslexia, in both math and reading.
I got on medication, requested extra time from my professors to complete exams, and sure enough, the A's began to roll in. With my GPA on the rise, and with a less generous financial aid package for year two at Regis, I searched for work. I landed a gig at Jasmine Sola, a retail store that sold designer denim and trendy clothing. I hadn't ever been in the same room with such expensive jeans. Some pairs were as much as $250. As I folded and hung them each evening, I drooled. Who had that much loot to drop on clothes? Oh, right, everyone in the store but me. I did, however, meet really interesting people while on the job. There was this one girl, petite, blonde, cute as a button, and a vision in baby pink. I instantly tried to look away. But even after all my crap, weird hang-ups, and promises to myself to have more girlfriends of color, Katie was the one white girl I could not pass up. She was, and still is, one of the most beautiful and caring people I've ever met. She wasn't afraid to call me out on my bullshit, or to let me call her out on hers. She saw me for who I really was, and she still wanted to be my friend. That kind of friendship has no color and no limits. We would talk all throughout our shifts while folding clothes and helping customers. We'd plan our futures and pick out clothes in the store we wanted to blow our paychecks on. It was a great time, and nothing could distract me from what I wanted to accomplish. During one of my shifts, a guy walked in. He was handsome, with dark features, about 5'11". Well-groomed, broad smile.
"Excuse me, miss," he said.
I turned, thinking he was ready to be rung up.
"May I ask your name?"
I blushed and smiled. "It's Diane," I said.
"I'd love to get your number," he said coolly.
I blushed harder. When I didn't answer, he reached into his jacket pocket and took out a pen and paper.
"Would that be okay?"
he asked. I nodded, grinned, and gave him my digits.
"My name's Brian, by the way," he told me.
He didn't take his eyes off me.
So much for not being distracted by boys. That weekend, Brian took me out for a nice dinner. And then a second one the Friday after. And then a third the next week. Dating was fairly new to me. The handful of times I'd gone out in high school, the dude and I would chill with a group at the movies or McDonald's. This was different. Brian was already out of college and had a real job. He'd call ahead to get on my calendar, choose a restaurant, swing by my dorm and pick me up, and then wine and dine me. I soaked up the attention. I also loved the freedom of not having to tell anyone who I was with or where I was going. We began seeing each other almost every weekend, and within a couple of months, we were chilling. I felt like a real grown-up. One afternoon, my friend Gemma came into my dorm room, energetic as always and holding a brochure. It was a study abroad application.
"Pack your bags," she said, in her best British accent. "We're going to London."
I'd heard about the program earlier, and although studying abroad was one of those things I dreamt about, I didn't let myself get too excited.
"Gemma, I can't go," I told her. "I'm broke as a joke. I can't go sip tea with you and the Queen."
I then turned back to my studies. But being the can-do, resourceful person that Gemma is, she completely ignored my whining and pessimistic attitude and said, "It has a great international relations program." I raised an eyebrow and thought, well, maybe. But just then, the flood of doubt came pouring in. How could I pay for this?
This isn't for girls like me. I paced and paced, trying to make sense of this crazy idea. Me? No, not me. I'm too poor.